Please be seated. Good morning. We have two rules hearings and then an open administrative conference this morning. And our first rules hearing is 12-03, In Re Proposed Amendments to the Wisconsin Statutes 80401, 80507, and 90503. According to my notes, the presenter will be Judge Sankovitz, who is a member of the Judicial Council's Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee. And Mr. Gleisner of the Judicial Council will make an appearance. Is there anyone else here who wants to appear in favor or opposed or neutral? Hearing none, at least that will be our start. Mr. Sankovitz.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm here as an ad hoc member of a subcommittee of the Judicial Council, and I'm pleased to speak to you this morning. I'm here with Bill Gleisner, who you may hear from in a moment, and April Southwick, who is the counsel to the council, Tom Burtz, who's another member of the council, and Judge Lineweber, who is an ad hoc member and was the chair of the subcommittee that's been working for all these years on electronic discovery. I'm going to keep my remarks brief, and I'm going to start with a story of brevity about Paul Freund. He's the legendary scholar of constitutional law at Harvard Law School, and he is widely regarded as having given the only perfect argument in the United States Supreme Court.
Did he win or did he lose?
What was that?
Did he win or did he lose?
The justices ruled unanimously in favor of the United States when he represented the United States as an assistant solicitor general back in the 30s. He was representing the government as a respondent. He waited for his opponent to give the opponent's remarks, take the opponent's turn. When it was his turn, he rose and he approached the podium and he said to the justices, "May it please the court, there's a typographical error at page 2 of our brief." And he went on to correct the error, and then he said, "If there are no questions, the government rests." Felix Frankfurter, for years after, told this story of this argument, and he said, "I've heard learned arguments, and I've heard eloquent arguments, and I've heard powerful arguments, but I've only heard one perfect argument." So I don't repeat that triumph today, but I can't, because we have April Southwick working for us, and there are no typographical errors in our petition. So I'll say instead, if there are no questions from the court, the Judicial Council rests.
I have a question.
Okay.
Asking more for a comment from you rather than any kind of particular concern. And it deals with the language of 80401.37. And the final sentence. Now, I know that this language, except for the title, is really identical to the comparable federal rule. And that last sentence says, "The producing party must preserve the information until the claim is resolved." So in other words, the first sentence of that is, "The information produced in discovery is subject to a claim of privilege." And it goes on to say what happens, of course, if something slips through, and then you've got to notify the recipient, and then the recipient can go into court. The recipient may promptly present the information to the court under seal for a determination of the claim. So it's not the recipient that has to preserve the information. It's the person who initially produced it. Is that how that works?
That's one possibility. This provision, which we call the clawback provision, basically freezes the situation until a court can rule. And it freezes it in a couple different ways. One way it freezes it, as you referred to, is the producing party recognizes the barn door was open, they figure out what document it was, and they preserve their copy of the information. On the receiving end, they have three choices. They can destroy it, and they can sequester it, which we interpret to mean they can preserve it without using it, or they can take their copy and turn it over to the court.
Well, your response, I had a similar question about the same thing, and your response is exactly what my question was, because in this provision, it's all ands. They preserve it. If I get a copy, you tell me, "Hey, I goofed, it's confidential, right? Now I got it." boy, it's dynamite. So I can say, I don't think so. And I can then present the information to the court under seal to say, I don't think it's protected. Okay. Now, if I have to do that, do I have to destroy it?
No, there's an or there.
No.
Return, sequester, or destroy.
I'm not returning it. I'm not. So the sequester is under seal? Is that the point?
Well, I think sequester is the equivalent of preserving it in confidence and not showing it to anybody.
But that's my problem. But if I'm challenging you, you're the producing party, and I'm going into court on it, do I have to take reasonable steps to retrieve the information? You see, these are all ands. That's what bothered me. But I tell you,
Is this situation. Let's say
The situation. You gave it to John Smith.
I gave it to my expert, for example, to look at. I'm the lawyer for the receiving party. I received this confidential information, and then I gave it to my expert to review.
Yeah.
What this rule requires is I get it back from the expert and hold on to it.
You surely should get it back if you agree that the claim of privilege is right. You have to get it back if you file in court too, right?
Even if you don't agree,
yeah.
As long as the producing party gives you notice, you have to get it back and hold on to it.
So when you talked, you said or, but all of this is and. Now, I would have drafted this differently, but it doesn't matter that I would have drafted it differently because I went back to the federal rules. And that's exactly the way they did. And then there's something to be gained by not changing the language of the federal rules, even though it's awkward, because then you get the advantage of what other states and the federal government does. But I found it somewhat complicated because it was too compact. It puts two ideas in there.
That's correct.
If you agree with the producing party, you do A, B, and C. If you disagree with the producing party, you have to do A, B, and C, and also file it in court. Do you know what I mean? It's just you don't have to do that because you're filing it in the court. They tried to pack too much into one sentence, but in light of that, I would not suggest this court redraft.
There's great virtue in uniformity, and I think throughout our proceedings with the session we had in 2010 and what we're doing now is saying if we're close to the federal rules, we should just adopt them verbatim rather than make these distinctions, which lawyers will argue about and which might create some uncertainty in the practice.
I agree with that, but I found it very difficult to follow.
Let me suggest this, too. If the court had to write a rule about the jitterbug, it'd be very difficult to reduce that to writing, but you don't have to, because anybody who knows how to dance a jitterbug knows that without you explaining it to them, and this is a dance.
Unless you think the jitterbug is a cell phone for seniors, which I recently bought for my mother. So when you started talking about the jitterbug, I'm like, oh, yeah, I've got one of those.
Okay. Well, there you go. We're in the electronic age now.
I'm so out of it, I didn't know that's a name.
This rule was meant to conform the rules to practice, and I think if you talk to people who practice, they know these rules without really having to look at them.
Well, they know it because they've gone to seminars, and the feds do it in a particular way, so I wouldn't touch it, but I do think it took me several rounds of reading and going into the federal rules to figure it out, so that's a... Unless you would suggest that we redo it.
No, that was really why I prefaced my comment the way that I did, because it was identical to the federal rule, so let it go is what I... But if you were drafting this and presenting it to the court as something new, I think it could use a little attention, perhaps. But that train has left the station.
And that train has left the station. Thank you.
I had a question, and it's this. In your petition, you have, on page 2. 2D is modeled on 45D2V, which was amended in 2007. There's no reference there to any federal notes, advisory notes, congressional notes. So wait until I finish this long question. So is there anything instructive there that should be referred to? Then on page 3, you say in your Judicial Council notes, which the notes are very good, the statement of congressional intent regarding Rule 502 are instructive, but no binding, in understanding the scope and purposes of those portions of 502 that are borrowed here. And then you go in, the various approaches available are discussed in the advisory committee note. And then you discuss SAMHSA, which is easily found. Got a reference to it. In judging whether the holder, it is appropriate to consider the non-disputed factors discussed in the advisory committee note. This is all to the feds, right? So here's my problem. I then said, okay, I'm going to go find these notes. Well, it wasn't easy. In fact, I'm not sure exactly, even when I found some. I found some in the Federal Civil Procedure and Rules. This is the 2007 revised edition because it's the only one I had around. Which was okay because you referred to 2006. So, excuse me. I found something. But it's long, and I don't know if you're referring to the entire comment in it or you're referring to parts thereof. And then I found in the Federal Rules of Evidence in Westlaw, and it's... advisory committee notes, and then it's 2011, and you have to plow through those, and then I finally got to, and I'm still not sure I'm at the right place. Statement of congressional intent regarding 502, and it's just four short paragraphs. So here's my point. And someone more familiar with federal rules than I spent about an hour trying to locate this and still not confident to what you are referring. I don't think, and you say in this petition that you want the notes, your advisory notes, published, and you want your comments published, but not, we don't adopt them. That's the usual general way. But the usual way, I hate to say usual because we're not always consistent, but often, at least in my memory and what I looked up, when there's reference to the feds, we put it in. So if you look at the rules of evidence that were drafted and adopted many a year ago, you'll see the feds, and elsewhere you see feds. So I really would strongly urge that part of the Federal Advisory Committee, that part of any of the other things you reference, because you may not be encompassing everything, be put in.
That sounds like a good idea to me.
Well, that was easy. I should have a button. I do. That was easy.
You're right. The advisory notes for the clawback rule are contained with all the advisory notes since 1962 was the first set of advisory notes to Rule 26. There are so many pages of advisory notes to Rule 26 in the federal rules that on the premier source of scholarship on the rules, which is the Legal Information Institute at Cornell, they can't even fit them on one web page. They actually have to go to a second web page, which means it's not even completely searchable when you get to the first web page. So I think it's a great idea.
As I say, I'm really glad because, one, they were hard to find. Two, they're so long that it's confusing as to what you're referring to. So I think that would really help that. And I assume that's easy to do because I assume you've got that. That is when I say you, the committee, subcommittee has that. Okay. The other thing that I was going to call to your attention in the courts was that your rule petition says that you want this published. Page 5, respectfully request the court publish the Judicial Council notes. Now, this is another issue that has come up recently, that the word publish has several meanings. So my question is, publish where? And I'm going to give you a lot of choices, which is the problem. We could publish it in the newspaper, you know, in the legal notices. That is not required. This is a 751.12. It's not required. The petition under 751.12 is required to be published, and I assume it has been published, which I could find out by just looking at that file, but not the order. Okay. We could publish it in the statute books or ask the revisor to do that, which you should want because this is a revision of statutes. Okay, so I assume when you say publish, that's one of the things you mean.
At least there, yes.
At least that, okay. The other publications are the State Bar, the
Wisconsin Lawyer.
Wisconsin Lawyer. I'm back to the bar bulletin. That's what it reads, but the Wisconsin Lawyer, okay. The court website, which will be done automatically. But, I mean, those are choices. The Wisconsin Second, the Northwest Second, or Third, I think we're still on Second. The online databases. Now, my assumption, if you tell me I'm wrong, is you'd like it in the statutes. You'd like it on the court website. You'd like it maybe I should ask you, do you want it in the Wisconsin Reporters?
I think any place that the court has the authority to order it published, it should order it published. But I don't think there's, you know, private sources out there that we have any control over it. They pick it up if they think it's worthwhile publishing. So if we can order it published in Callahan, which I think that's our right to do, if we can order it, if we publish it on our website, and if we order the bar to publish it, then I think that accomplishes the kind of putting the court's imprimatur on it and leading the market to understand this is what the court believes the rule is and the commentary is useful to the rule, and you should publish it too.
So, any place is accessible to lawyers and the public.
Right.
Okay.
I think is the protocol we followed in previous rules.
In what?
In publishing previous rules, I think we followed that protocol.
Well, there are lots of different things we do. It's okay. Not consistent, so that's one of the problems. But I just wanted to know. So, what do you mean by published? On page 16, and you and I discussed this yesterday in Milwaukee, you note that the Wisconsin courts have yet to encounter significant issues with discovery and production. So that's still true. It was true when you brought in the first one. And then what you're doing is going ahead of the curve, which is unusual for law, but good. All right. And that's still true.
Yes, we can take some great pride in being prepared.
Good. All right. So I have no further questions on this. Let's see if anyone else does. Justice Prosser.
I'd like to go back to the section that Justice Bradley was talking about and ask you to kind of walk through for me what counsel for the receiving party does. The producing party turns over a document of some sort, and the first part of the rule talks about return, sequester, destroy, including copies. But I think the rule contemplates the litigation of the producing party's claim.
Kind of plays that possibility. It says it may.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes parties will recognize, yep, that was a big mistake. Let's see if we can put this toothpaste back in the tube and move on, and it's too expensive to go to court and fight about it. So in some cases, there won't be a fight. But in other cases, there will, and this rule gives both parties an open door to the courthouse to have the court resolve the question. And then we've actually created the rule of decision in our other proposed amendment to the evidence or the privilege rules that gives the court the rule for how to decide this dispute.
My real question goes to when there is that sort of litigation. If I were the attorney representing the receiving party, and somehow I wanted that information because I have read it, am I supposed to memorize it? I mean, do you get to argue content at all?
Oh, sure. I mean, in the typical practice, and it wouldn't surprise me as a trial judge, for the parties to submit both their briefs under seal with the disputed documents attached so I can see them.
Okay. So in that sense, the counsel for the receiving party may retain.
Sure. That's sequester is what I would consider that part of sequestering.
Oh, that's what sequester means. Okay. Okay.
I think we treat those documents just like jurors, just like witnesses. We put them somewhere where they, in a soundproof booth, in a hermetically sealed jar somewhere where nobody can get at them until the court gets at them.
If I may, when I read that sequester, I thought, okay, put it in my bottom desk drawer. It's not normally where we put jurors.
Wasn't sequester the term that the president used during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that we were sequestering Cuba from shipments from Russia? I mean, sequester is an old-fashioned term, has a lot of different uses, but I think we can use it here in the context that in the sense that the context implies, which is to hold on to it just so nobody else can see it, and that secret can't be released any further.
Thank you.
I have a question, somewhat related, but off topic, too. You're on the Committee on Civil Rules, too.
I'm kind of an ad hoc member, yes.
Okay. I wrote Ms. Southwick some time back and have been concerned because across the country, there's been concern that we should simplify our version of the federal rules of civil procedure for access to justice. It's too complicated if you're going to represent yourself, and it may even be too complicated for lawyers and cause delay and increased costs. And I think Colorado has been one of the leaders and may have even adopted some of those rules. When I've talked to members of the bar about this over the years, no one has expressed great interest for the same reason they don't express great interest in this electronic record keeping, because they just haven't had to face up to these difficult issues and they're familiar with the rules and it works for them. So do you have any views on that while you're here?
Let me just throw this suggestion out. It's the way we deal with these issues in Milwaukee, and we would deal with the issues created by these new rules the same way. We have local rules. Our local rules are not meant to supplant the state rules, but sometimes we can translate them for people who represent themselves and make them easier to follow, and we've done that. We have a small claims manual that sets forth rules that are the same rules you'd find in the statutes but in a little bit plainer language. We have rules that govern our procedures in family court and in the civil courts that are also designed to make this a little bit easier. That's not the end of the story. There has to be some role played by the judge and the judicial assistant to also convey the same thing to litigants. So I think one thing you hear in this movement for procedural justice, that's the kind of buzzwords for let's communicate to people so they actually understand what we're trying to get them to understand, that's part of that translation process. So I think it would be a monumental effort and maybe a monumental waste to rewrite our statutory rules to make them say what they say more plainly, because we don't need to if on the communicating end, in our courtrooms, in our courthouses, we provide people with a plain language translation.
I think this movement is broader than just plain language rules. I think it's simplification of the rules so that you don't have to necessarily take the steps that you take now. I mean, it covers a ton of potential things. And so I just haven't heard this groundswell here to do that, that the rules, and many of our rules are based on the federal rules, as the other states are, but there's still this groundswell across the country, not to just plain language them, but to change them.
And actually make the procedures simple. I understand
exactly.
That. I mean, we have three different rules for how you can get judgment before trial, and people would say, well, why not just make it one?
Right.
Well, for people who operate at the refined level that the court operates at, there are three distinct ways that things can be resolved. So you need three rules, but you don't need to say three different rules to somebody who's having their mortgage foreclosed on.
Or even the lawyers. Why do they have to have three different rules?
I can see some could and some couldn't. But I think the main thing there is that whether you call it plain language or simple procedures, it's on the translating end where I think that changes can be accomplished without having to have somebody sit down and rewrite all of our statutes.
Right. Thank you.
I have one comment. As you know, I've been very interested in electronic discovery, and I really want to thank you for remaining on the committee when your term of service was actually over and you could have left. I think you and the rest of the committee have done just a wonderful job, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joseph.
The rest of us don't care.
Take it for granted. That's fine.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Judge. Mr. Gleisner.
May it please the court, I'm Bill Gleisner, and I've been on the committee that has issued this petition or prepared this petition since 2008 when this was first considered by the committee, and I want to endeavor to do at least as well as Judge Sankovitz and say ditto everything he said. And I'll take any questions the court has.
Good for you. If I recall, you wrote the book on this issue.
I've written a book on it. That's right, Justice. And it's still good. So, thank you.
That didn't influence your vote on the Judicial Council, though.
Yes,
Jane. Did? Okay, good.
I'm revealing my ignorance. Is inadvertent defined somewhere?
Well, Justice, I think it's defined in the case law on the federal level for certain as to what inadvertent disclosure is. This court has defined fairly well what it isn't, I think, in the Sampson case, which is referenced in our petition, where there was a deliberate disclosure, and as Judge Sankovitz has pointed out to me, and I think it's pretty clear from the petition, a deliberate disclosure is different than an inadvertent disclosure under the Sampson case, so the Sampson case continues good law.
Well,
but inadvertent means accidental, by mistake.
But look, when a lawyer gives, when I'm the producing lawyer and I give you all this material, I intentionally, deliberately give you that material. It is not inadvertent. I have given it to you. What happened, and this is what the Sampson case says, and I reread it. I wrote it, but I reread it. I wrote the book on this one. It says, sure, it was deliberate that it produced these documents, but it didn't. The producer did not know or consider whether it was privileged. That is, shouldn't have been communicated, and that's where it drew the distinction. And when I read this,
I don't know what the feds or any other court is doing as to whether inadvertent means the production, because the production is going to be, unless they deliberately set it aside somewhere in the office and then it came out anyway, that might be inadvertent. But usually it's gone, and it's all deliberately gone. It's just that they weren't paying attention or couldn't see it, blah, blah. So I don't know what inadvertent means in the feds.
Chief, I have the same problem. I wrote a memo back in November of 2008 stating that I thought that the Sampson case was going to be difficult to draft a rule around the Sampson case. The thing I would say is that Mr. Elliott in the Sampson case didn't even realize that the documents were privileged and gave them up.
That's right.
On purpose. And
that's what the case said.
Right. It certainly did, Your Honor. And the thing that I fear is that there's going to be a need for clarification by this court down the road when somebody produces a large mass of documents and maybe use
intentionally and deliberately.
And maybe use predictive coding, which is, you know, a review of documents by computer. And first time he or she learns that a privileged document was produced is when it comes back to him or her in the exhibit list just before trial. And it's going to be too late to invoke the clawback rule at that point. And I think there are rough edges here. There's no question about it.
I think that's a rough edge. A smile comes to my face because I think of the examples that I just heard about, you know, what does inadvertence mean? Mm-hmm. We're familiar with a rule, 806071A, which is relief from judgment. And 1A says, what does it say? Inadvertence, mistake, or excusable neglect. And so some of the examples I heard sounded a little bit like neglect or mistake. So inadvertence must mean something different. And what does it mean? I can hardly wait to get that.
And I would remark in that regard, on the federal level, Federal Rule Civil Procedure 26 didn't really address the issue of attorney-client privilege and work product. And so the Congress was the one that enacted Rule 502 of the Federal Rules of Evidence.
Which is referred to in the notes, which I want put in here so we have some concept of what we're talking about.
I think that's an extremely good idea. I think also that the federal litigation is going to be missing one component when they address issues such as this, and they have addressed issues such as this, and that is the Sampson case. Because in Wisconsin, we have a little different rule where there's a deliberate disclosure. And I can hear counsel arguing when this exhibit comes back to them at the time of the pretrial, oh, but the client didn't authorize that. And therefore, I'm home free under Sampson. We'll see.
Your memo to the petition says, hey, no problem, Sampson. I mean, there may or may not be a problem. The whole point, though, about a rule is legislation cannot and does not cover every single fact situation that comes up. In fact, even if you tried, you're going to miss the one that does come up.
Right.
So that's why the courts are into statutory interpretation or interpretation of the rules, because they've got to apply this rule as best we understand its background and purpose in a fact situation that's not the usual one.
Chief, the rules that have been adopted, especially because they do tie into the federal rules so well and therefore make the decisional library on the federal level available and other states available, the rules that have been drafted are a major step forward. And I'm very active in the Wisconsin Association of Justice, and the 1,000 or so trial lawyers in that organization, I've asked, they haven't expressed any major concerns. There's always going to be rough edges, and that's what courts such as this exist for, to deal with those rough edges.
Yeah, I'm surprised that a disclosure of the type you talk about hasn't occurred on a fairly regular basis when you have very, very large t-
types of litigation, and the discovery is done for electronic, of course, information, and there's a search set up, and maybe the search terms weren't particularized enough, or for whatever reason, a document came through, and you wouldn't know it came through until someone sent it back to you, because the reason you use the search terms is so you don't look at every single document that's in an electronic library.
And, Justice, I spoke with Matt Stippich yesterday from Digital Intelligence, who they're a forensic computer firm I've used and others have used. Yeah. I think that there are confrontations of a sort going on between counsel, but none of them have broken through to the appellate courts or to any published decisions at this point. That's what I was really referring to. And nobody has expressed any concerns like, oh, this is just not going to work.
Yeah.
To my ears, anyway.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, the feds have had issues about, they've drafted rules on electronic matters, and they have amended them and amended them and amended them, and I don't know where the Seventh Circuit is on its local rules. So it's a learning process, because this mm-hmm. is an area in which is new, relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is going to be a work in progress. And I think your committee, when it presented its first petition, called it a work in progress and said, hey, we're only covering this sliver of this issue. We're going to have to come back and cover different slivers, but we're just taking one little step at a time.
I commend this court for adopting those rules that were submitted under Petition 0901, supplemented today, because I think we're in a very good position to deal with any problems that do come up as they come up, unlike a lot of jurisdictions.
And if the feds amend again, we may or may not have to. You may be back here saying, hey, we want to be consistent.
Yes, Chief. They're not right now. The United States Conference, Judicial Conference, is not considering any amendments, but that may well come to pass with cloud computing and some of the other innovations that are going on.
Well, maybe everyone is waiting to see how this is all going to work out.
I think so, Chief.
Well, the feds are studying it. Aren't they studying it right now to see the problems that are arising under the rules of electronic discovery? And hopefully when they're concluded, they'll issue a report and we'll all benefit from that.
The pilot project of the Seventh Circuit is looking at this. The Federal Advisory Committee of the Judicial Conference of the United States is looking at this. Right now, they're looking at two areas. They're looking at this point at predictive coding and cloud computing, and they have said that they're not going to revise the rules en masse until about 2013, 14.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all waiting to see what they do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
One step at a time.
Baby steps.
May I follow up on one of your comments? I think you said the proposed rules basically are inspired by, based on, follow the federal rules.
Yes.
And then you said, and of course we can turn to federal decisional law to help us interpret the Wisconsin rules. This is bread and butter stuff. Are there any cautionary notes at all with respect to turning to federal precedent?
Well, Justice, I'm sure there will be. I'm sure that there will be things that arise that are going to be affected by peculiarities of Wisconsin law. But I must say that I'm a strong supporter of the federal rules. I review them and the cases that have come down under them every year for the pocket part of the book that I've written. I must say that I think the feds are doing a pretty good job in this area. And those rules decisions, especially the FRD decisions, provide counsel on both sides of a discovery issue with ample authority to at least make cogent arguments one way or the other, which wouldn't exist if we had to rely just on Wisconsin authority. I agree with Justice Rogensack when 0901 was before this court that having the ability to go to the federal decisional library is a real plus in this area.
Well, the fact that you have all these cases means there are just lots of problems not covered by the rules.
That's true.
Because if it was all clear and covered by the rules, you wouldn't be having these cases.
That's right, Chief.
The federal rule of decisions, usually trial court decisions not published in the
very often that's the case.
Sub-second.
And on the federal level, of course, we have the benefit of the trial court decisions because they appear in the supplement.
That's right. Well, you can now publish, if this is adopted, another supplement.
Yes, Chief.
I forget, is our Wisconsin proposed rule consistent on the context of law issue with the federal rule?
Are you referencing the rules that are now before you in this petition?
That's right. I just forget. I was looking at it.
They're very consistent, Justice. They're modeled very much on FRCP 26 and on Federal Rule of Evidence 502. And
I should have asked a better question. As I understand in the 502, in large part, one of the differences is the forfeiture waiver stuff, and that's why we're here with some changes. Mm-hmm. I just don't remember, and I was just starting to look. With regard to the issue of what do we do when I say conflict of law, I was using shorthand. What do we do when it's released in another jurisdiction?
Oh,
do we employ their law? Do we employ our law? There's some reference, of course, to comity and federalism, mm-hmm. and our nod to those principles. So how do we come out in our rule vis-a-vis the federal rule on those issues of comity and federalism?
I thought Ms. Southwick dealt with that pretty well in the petition memo when she said that that would be a matter, I think, for conflict of law issue resolution.
Here's what the petition says, page 5. Out of respect for principles of federalism and comity, sub 5 doesn't conclusively resolve whether privileged communications inadvertently disclosed in proceedings in other jurisdictions may be used in Wisconsin, nor whether privileged communications inadvertently disclosed in Wisconsin may be used in other jurisdictions. Sub 5 states that it applies regardless of where the disclosure occurs, but to the extent that the law of another jurisdiction controls the question, it is not trumped by 5. The prospect for actual conflict is minimized because 5 is the same or similar to the rule applied in the majority of jurisdictions. Conflicts do arise because a rule dictates a disclosure in a jurisdiction other than Wisconsin should be treated as a forfeiture, court should consider choice of law. So it's not finalized, et cetera. What happens if we change our case law on forfeiture and waiver?
Well, Chief, obviously that's going to have an effect on our version of 502. I also would respectfully observe that there are, as we state at page 15 to 16 of the petition memo, states that have deviated considerably from 502 and from other aspects of our adoption of Rule 26. And when a disclosure occurs or doesn't occur in one of those jurisdictions, I think we're going to have to do the usual contacts analysis and the choice of law analysis. And with regard to waiver and forfeiture, if we change our definitions there, this court is going to be confronted with another rough edge that it will have to smooth over. I don't think it's going to necessarily result in the rules that this court is considering. It's already adopted pursuant to 0901 and is considering with respect to this petition. I don't think it's going to result in throwing them out unless the court takes a radical different direction, and I don't see that happening.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Judge.
Is there anyone else who would like to appear on 12-03 relating to 80401, 80507, and 90503? If not, this hearing is closed. I'll now call on hearing in 1205, in re amendment of SCR 7201, 03, 04, 05, and 801, 17, 807, 06, 809, 15, relating to record retention and electronically or optically stored records.
Good morning, Chief. Good morning, Justices. Good to see you again.
Our presenter is the Honorable James Pfeiffer, for Waukesha County Circuit Court, and the other appearance is David Callender, Wisconsin County Association. Will anyone else be appearing for or against this petition? You may proceed, Judge.
Thank you, Chief. Before I begin, this is always a tough act to follow whenever you follow Sankovitz and Gleisner here. I also wanted just to introduce a couple people today. My wife came with me today here, and just to see the workings of the court as she has done in the past, and then also Amber Peterson, who is to my right. Amber works with the director of state court's office and their court operations, and Amber did the yeoman's part of this work here. So, and I know she was obviously putting a lot of time and effort into this here because, as Amber told me, this is the first time she's had this opportunity to present and to be in front of the Supreme Court in this type of setting. So again, I wanted to thank her for all of her work. As I listened to the exchanges in court here today, it reminded me of a motion hearing I had this past Monday. The briefs and everything else that was submitted to me were this large, and I was working on it over the weekend and working in between Sunday night football game and this and that. And I got it all done, and I ended up remarking to my wife that the matter had been scheduled. I had recently been rotated back into the civil division. So this case had been scheduled by my predecessor, Judge Hassan, and they had scheduled like two and a half hours of court time for these summary judgment motions. And I'm always a proponent of case management here in getting to the point, and I remarked to my wife that I can picture when I have the lawyers in front of me that they're going to be expecting to regurgitate everything that's been written before, and I don't like that. If I take the time and the effort to read everything here, and I tell that to my audience before I begin, I really don't want to hear it all back again. So that two-and-a-half-hour hearing went down to 15 minutes, and the matter was disposed of. So whether that comes in front of you or not, that awaits a different day. But that leads me to this point. It's pretty evident to me after listening to the exchanges on the prior petition that I know all of you have read through the petition and the memorandums that were submitted in advance of that. And rather than me regurgitating and repeating everything all over once again, because it's pretty evident to me that you've done all of this and you've read all of this here. As Judge Sankovitz did, I'll simply say, do you have any questions? Because hopefully I can answer them for you. And if I can't, I'll turn to Amber, who I know has worked, as I've indicated, quite extensively on this here. Chief, I know you always have questions.
Well, I'll tell you. I've heard this discussed by staff at staff meetings, because the staff is involved in this record retention. And we've gotten several comments about the original petition, and you've amended in regard to those comments. As staff will probably tell you, my eyes sort of glaze over on record retention because it is so detailed. And, lien complaint claims, they're kept for 30 years. Some are kept for 75 years, like guardianship, and you've changed that. So if the person dies, at least you can get rid of the records. Although well, maybe there'll be problems about some of the records in a probate matter. I don't know. So it would help, I think, if you would, and the county association is going to appear. They sent, did you see their letter?
From Mr. Callender, yeah. Yes. And I spoke to him a little bit before the hearing this morning, too.
So we got that on the 17th, and they raise questions. Like, what items must be retained from a criminal trial? Firearms, drugs, cash, forensic evidence, blood and tissue samples, clothing, and large photographs. Do they require special treatment like the blood might, but probably don't generally do that? Should they be kept in a secure area? And under whose authority? And this has come up, I think, in cases. Is it kept in the sheriff's department? Is it kept by the clerk of court? Is it put in wherever the record is transferred to? Or is it kept by county facilities? So they're concerned about the logistic and financial burden on the counties. And so maybe you could talk about what issues have arisen, why you've made decisions, and the county association.
Well, Chief, I've been on the bench 28 years, and I've dealt with exhibits, obviously, many, many times here. And there's a new format that I think a lot of judges are turning to now. Typically what happens is at the end of the case, the clerk presents to the opposing sides here the actual exhibit list itself. And at the bottom of that exhibit list is an area for the attorneys to sign his or her name as to whether they want those exhibits to be returned to whoever offered the exhibit. And then they can say yes or no to that. And it's been my experience that...
Even if they're accepted in evidence?
Correct, because... and now that may be problematic in and of itself here, too. But that is what is occurring on the trial court level here. Many times, for instance, I know in Mr. Callender's concerns here, dealing with, for instance, blood or drugs or money, those types of guns, for example, those materials are typically turned over to the investigating agency to maintain, and it's been my experience that everyone agrees that that's the appropriate way to handle it here. So as I understand it, and I'll speak from Waukesha County in particular, when it comes to those matters, the clerks do not keep those, even though they've been admitted, because there's been an agreement on the record that the investigating agency will continue to maintain that and will continue to hold that until the applicable time limits have expired.
And will that be these rules? So you turn it over to the sheriff's department. Does the sheriff have to comply with these rules?
Well, they'll need to because, I mean, those are actually part of the exhibits, but that's the practicalities as to what actually happens in the trial court setting itself here. The clerk is the custodian of all of those records, all of those exhibits, the et cetera, et cetera. And so it's been my experience that that has never been an issue at all. And as I understand it also around the state, counties handle this somewhat individually. It may be different, for instance, in Marathon County or Brown County, Washington County, whatever the case may be. But the clerks, as I understand it, when these proposals came forward, they did not have any problems with this, nor the concerns of Mr. Callender as to how these are going to be handled. It has not been an issue in the past.
Well, this rule proposal, I don't know, I'm checking who got it. I don't know if the sheriff's associations are generally on this, but they've been so inundated with the rules, they prefer that we tell them only if we think it affects them, but I don't know if they got it. I mean, if they know it affects them,
I don't have my sheet here as to who all got copies of the actual petition itself here. But it is, I'm representing to the court that it has not ever been any concern that I've ever heard in my years on the bench.
Well, I want to tell you that you say you've been on the bench 28 years. I want you to know that today we're celebrating 35 years that Justice Crooks has been on the bench. And
so
that's
with parties at about 6:30.
That's what I was going to tell you. The importance of that is his office supplies goodies.
Good.
Next time you come, consider that before you tell us how long you've been on the bench. Well, you'll have to supply the goodies.
Yesterday I had a phone call also with two attorneys, one from Green Bay and one from Milwaukee. And the Milwaukee, his name was Ben Proctor. And I said to, I could tell this was a younger man, I could tell where this was headed, and I said, are you related to the Ben Proctor from Eau Claire? He goes, yes, that's my dad. And I thought, it's real subtle how time goes by here, that the new generation of lawyers are coming on and they bear the same names as their mother or their father. Last name, that is here. So. Mm-hmm.
Yep, we know him. He interned for the court.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, that's an issue then as to that these records are really not kept within the court family necessarily.
Those types that were concerns that were raised by Mr. Callender typically are not.
Mm-hmm. Well, they may come into civil cases too, of course.
Well, could be, yes. I'm not doubting that. How that would be handled, I don't know. I have not had that type of specific experience. I've seen it in criminal, but not in civil yet.
Mm-hmm. Judge Kiefer, and I know this isn't directly what you're looking at, but you know how in OWI cases they look back for what would be a civil violation for a first offense?
Right.
Have you taken a look at that at all? Do we keep those long enough for people to be able to pull those if needed in a subsequent prosecution?
Well, this is not part of the petition, but it's under sub 45 dealing with, that would be considered a civil exhibit. And
right.
That
or
is
a civil case, right? A traffic forfeiture,
right?
Which is kept, I think, for 5 years after entry of final judgment. Is that long enough for, you know, how they count them now? Because those statutes seems like they constantly get revised a little bit, made a little tougher or a little different. And I just wonder if anyone's taken a look at that. That's an issue for a different day. But it might be that should be updated, because if you can't get the file, you can't prove the prior. If you can't prove the prior, you don't have a conviction. You know what I'm saying?
Well, the challenge is on the level of the collateral attacks that you speak of, that typically goes to whether the person was advised of their right to gave up their specific rights for county purposes, the right to an attorney, et cetera, whether they waived, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that's on a civil realm that they're not required to do that, but typically it comes like on the second or the third of the challenges, the collateral attacks here.
I've had that happen. Where, for example, you know, back on the bench, when it'd be an out-of-state conviction, for example, and then the motion would be made, this can't be counted because they can't prove it, because the records weren't retained in that jurisdiction long enough for, and I know you can't deal with out-of-state, but in Wisconsin, do we at least keep those long enough so that Wisconsin OWIs could, you know, you could look back and find the record if someone wanted to say, it's not me, it's not my prior.
Well, if you're dealing with an OWI second or third or fourth, et cetera, all of those would be under our criminal exhibits here. And those, under this proposal, they would be retained for 20 years after.
That's not what I'm worried about. But when you're charged with the second or charged with the third or charged with the fourth, and the reason why it's a second, third, or fourth is because of that civil prior.
First.
Is that kept? That's the only point. And it's not, I'm not trying to put you on the hot spot. I'm just saying if you're looking at these things, maybe just double check to make sure that's kept long enough, because I think it's only 5 years.
Are you concerned about the blood sample itself here, that type of?
No, the proof of the, you know, the file. The
actual record itself here?
Yeah, okay. In the civil, because the first OWI is civil, and those are held a different period of time. Right? 5 years, not
right.
20.
Right.
You know, and there's a reason why you keep the second and third and fourth, for example, for 20 or
right.
whatever, right? But sometimes
you know, it makes a difference if you can prove that first. It makes a difference on whether it's a fifth or whether it's a fourth if you can't prove the first. Am I making sense to you?
No, I fully understand that, because sometimes trying to recreate records, particularly from out of state, is very difficult at best.
But, I mean, at least in our own state, we should make sure we're consistent with what the law says you can look back to and how we retain those records.
I don't believe, Justice, that that was ever discussed with respect to this petition.
Right, and I'm not trying to put you on. I'm really not. I'm just saying if you're ever looking at these issues again, that'd be one to take a closer look at, because that would, I mean, that's a, if you can't prove someone has that prior, it's not necessarily a second, third, fourth, fifth, or whatever.
And I've had that several times.
So. Right. It's not unique. So just so that at least it's consistent within our own law. It may not be for out of state, but within our own law, we keep them for the right period of time, you know, if it's whatever it is, because that law keeps evolving.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, I know.
It's an idea.
Noting that here. So we may be back here.
Sure. Sorry.
There have been responses to this petition already referred to that respond to exhibit retention, that respond to the 75-year amendment. But I want to talk about something less litzy, and that is the lien claim amendment.
Mm-hmm.
I come with the belief that it is in the interest of the court system to keep records as long as necessary, but no longer than necessary. And I'm sure the clerks within the court system are concerned about keeping records when they no longer need to or it's no longer meaningful. With that by way of preface, I look at the proposed language of the lien claim, and what it is doing is setting a time period certain. It is setting 30 years after the date of the filing of the lien with the clerk of court. And it is taking out or deleting the proposal the language until satisfaction or expiration of the lien or entry of judgment, whichever occurs first. My question is this. If the lien has been satisfied, or there is an expiration of the lien in year 5, year 10, or year 15, why should the clerks be keeping it for 30? It seems to me a waste if it's no longer in existence much earlier. So,
it's an excellent concern. I think the reason for the original amendment on the petition was to make things more consistent with the other rules, the other Supreme Court rules dealing with these types of liens here, because this was different than the others. The change itself here was modified just to bring that consistency within the actual rules themselves here. I think, Justice, with the age that we are now in and scanning things here, that and I know the clerks have voiced concerns in this petition regarding storage space, but I think that becomes less and less of a concern when things are scanned electronically into the record, and therefore the paper that is there that leads to the storage issues is no longer an issue anymore here.
If it's no longer an issue anymore, then
I have it.
Why have any of this?
Okay.
I just scan them and keep them in the cloud somewhere in perpetuity.
That may apply to a lot of these things that you see here today. For instance, I was thinking this out on the way up this morning here, too, about, for instance, with probate records. As I understand the Supreme Court rule, you maintain a probate record, I think it's 75 years after, I believe it's the final judgment is entered. I don't have the specifics on that. And I wondered, well, why would we need to keep something of somebody who has already passed away? Why do we need to keep it 75 years? And there's, I think, valid reasons why it could be less, but I think those are time periods that have been come up with to be consistent with other statutes here, just as we have, I believe, here with the guardianship matters here, the mental health issues, some of the juvenile records here, to keep it out 75 years because of the firearms issues here.
It could be. I guess my sense is with regard to the lien claim amendment that it could read until satisfaction or expiration of the lien or 30 years after the date of filing the lien claim with the clerk of circuit court, whichever occurs first. Again, if it is satisfied within 5 years or 2 years or 3 years, apparently the only reason to keep it 30 years is because that number meshes with another number someplace else that has 30 years. That's an explanation, but it's not very persuasive to me, because if it's satisfied within 2 years, it seems to me the option should not be kept, should be that they don't have to keep the record any longer. Having said that, I understand that the struggle over record retention is becoming less important, given that these are electronically stored and space may not be an issue. But then that causes me to rethink the last 20 years of your life that you've dedicated to record retention issues, and I know you have, and you've been a real soldier and steward in that area.
I think Justice, part of it too is just to have consistency on the clerk's level, because if you have this type of rule just for this type of lien, and then you have this rule for this, and then this for this, I think that's where it gets problematic with the Clerks Association. As I understand it, that they would prefer to have that consistency so there's just, it's one rule, they know how to apply it. The other concern that I have is that if, for example, if one of these liens is satisfied or it expires, you get to the issue of how do the clerks become aware of that? What type?
Satisfaction.
Correct, or the expiration of the lien here, I guess. But then that, I think, would probably require possibly more work by the Clerks Association to monitor that with that specific item, as opposed to just simply, it's 30 years, this is when this was done, it's now it now can be destroyed.
The petition recommends the court creates a comment to 720146, and the comment defines exhibits for purposes of 7201, 45, and 46. So in non-criminal cases, one year after the time of appeal has expired, provided that return of the exhibit has been offered to the parties. And 46, criminal, 1 year after the time for appeal is expired, provided the return of the exhibit has been proffered to the parties, offered to the parties. So, exhibit is defined as submitted to the court during the trial and marked with an official exhibit sticker. That refers to whether it's introduced or not, whether the court allows it to be introduced.
Right.
If it's not marked with a sticker, the court doesn't have to retain it?
Well, that goes to what happens each and every day on the trial court level. Lawyers, whenever they're in a position of asking any question, need to obviously mark their exhibits, and it's all another issue whether it's later even offered, admitted, denied, or withdrawn.
And sometimes it's done before, you know, the trial starts. They put it all in a pile of the label them and then refer to them as the trial proceeds.
My clerk always hates that because they go off on their own tangent on the number system, which differs from what my clerk wants to do. And so, but we run into a little tension there. But.
Okay. So if it's put a sticker on it, but it's not ever referred to, or they put a sticker on and it's not taken as it's not introduced and accepted by the court, is it an exhibit to be retained?
That's an excellent question, because sometimes that does happen in the trial court setting. I know when lawyers mark all these exhibits, I know this has been my practice, I will then ask the attorney, what about exhibit number 22? Oh, Judge, we're not going to deal with that here. I've decided to go off in a different direction, so it's been marked. It's never been offered and obviously not received, et cetera, here. So what do you do with that here?
What do you do with it?
That may be an issue where if it's been marked, then maybe the petition needs to be amended to indicate that it's whether it's been marked and offered, received, withdrawn, denied. This request comes from the clerk's office, as I understand it, that they get these questions throughout the state as to exactly what do you mean by the term exhibit. So this is trying to give them some...
Because this is new. I mean, the word exhibit is not new. It's in the present SCR. But this comment is new.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
But if the exhibit is used, for example, with a witness versus just marked ahead of time and they decide not to use it, whether they offer it or not, is it your understanding that's kept in the file?
That, I think, is almost the same type of question as I understand it that Chief Justice Abramson also asked here.
She said if it was offered or moved, and she also said if it's marked but never used. But there's something in between those two.
Right. There is.
Where you mark it, you use it with a witness, but you forget to move it. Or maybe it's denied when you move it in.
I look at that. If something has been marked, Justice, and if it's been denied, obviously, as I understand this rule, that is considered an exhibit under this particular definition here. I thought there was an instance in which where attorneys simply pre-mark exhibits here. They never even get to it. They never make any reference
That's
to
different.
It at all during the course of a hearing, whether they do that directly or indirectly.
But my question isn't that one. It's in between those two. Mm-hmm. Does this rule speak to when it's marked, it's used with a witness, actually used, not just sitting there and they decide not to use it, but actually used? Does this rule speak to that issue?
Well, that's how I interpreted this particular definition, because it was submitted to the court during the course of a trial or hearing, and it was marked with an official exhibit sticker here. So my answer to your inquiry would be, yes, that would be considered an exhibit.
So you think submitting to the court could mean just questioning a witness, even if you don't offer it?
That's how I would look at that.
I just wondered if you thought that was covered.
When there is a time period for retention set out in the rules, is there authority for either counsel to move or the court to order a longer time period?
Beyond these rules?
Extended time period, something like that.
Beyond these rules, Justice?
Yeah.
I've never heard of anything. There is a statutory reference. I believe it's in Chapter 755 or 757 that indicates that the handling of the exhibits is... or what happens with exhibits is actually handled by Supreme Court rules. There's an exception because there's a whole other statutory section dealing with biological materials that deal with DNA, and there's a process that can be used because that's got a different retention period than other types of exhibits here. I don't believe that there would be – I've never heard of anything like that here. I don't think that there could be – I'm not aware of any reason why you couldn't do that. The limits are out there so far that I'm just curious as to why they would want to extend them even further than that. I think the rules were set up, Justice, in order to deal with it, try to put it out the outermost as possible within reason here.
you talked about stipulations by counsel of exhibits that could go back to people. And you talked about some other things where discretionary decisions are made. Does the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel ever come up?
I have not heard that. I have not heard that. But I think that that could be an argument that could be made. Why was a particular exhibit returned and then possibly lost forever here because this attorney had agreed to it, when a different attorney looking at these types of issues in hindsight would say that should have been retained?
My recollection is that's a specific court form that was developed. I mean, that was back when I was on the bench,
correct,
too. Do you remember the number of that form by any chance, so it's easy for the justices to put their hands on it? No.
I have a stack of that on my bench here.
And you just hand them.
I think it's a CV form. I think it's 110. It's right at the very, very beginning of.
But it was a form developed by the records or the committee. I mean, it's a specific court form that we require judges to use.
Correct. And then we expanded that form here to deal with the issue we just talked about here, because clerks were saying that they have all these exhibits there that just kind of sit in this record and they go nowhere. Again, you get to an issue of storage here, when many times the attorneys agree, yes, they can be returned mm-hmm. to the proffering party. And then they sign off on that.
They agreed to keep them, I think, for the appellate time period or something.
They
if
should.
I remember that on the form on the bottom.
Fingers crossed that's what they're doing because it's back in their hands.
I mean, that's what we require, so we can't really complain
right.
about that unless we want to get rid of the form. What do you do if the attorneys don't agree that the exhibits they submitted are to be retained by the person submitting them through the appellate process?
Then they remain part of the actual court file itself.
Okay, so they just stay?
Correct.
Okay.
And then you get to these rules as to how long you actually retain them here.
Okay, thank you.
You have modified your petition, as I read it, in a letter dated September 12, 2012. Correct me if I'm wrong. In response to comment received regarding this petition.
There were a couple letters, Justice, if you could. Was this one dealing with the guardianships, or was this the one with exhibits?
This is the one with guardianships.
Guardianships, okay.
In response to Sally Lund's
Lundy.
Letter dated August 29th. And so if you could highlight for us the now import of the changes to your petition that you're requesting that we make. I note just parenthetically that there is a need for typographical error, which I assume is typographical, which is page 3 of the letter dated September 12, 2012, and that is that for the first time the word firearms is plural rather than singular, so I just note that you would not be able then to make the same opening comment that Judge Sankovitz made about the perfect moral argument.
You know, we do have an opening. We just had a recent opening on records management here. But,
funny you mention that
because yesterday, when I was going through this, I happened to note that that word became plural as opposed to singular throughout
yes.
here. So I think that is something that should be deleted. The plural, it should be singular to be consistent with all of the other references.
All I can say is great minds think alike.
Yeah, well, you noted that. That's
good. Right. But if you could highlight for the court or touch upon the changes to the petition that you're now asking that we incorporate.
In that area?
Yes.
Just on the guardianship area here?
Or it's,
okay.
yeah. I'll start with that area, but it might edify us to make sure that we're going to be voting on isn't just a matter of, oh, I approved the petition without word change, because you're now asking for changes to the initial petition.
Well, the original petition, just dealing with guardianships, mental health, and then certain juvenile delinquency files here, they had a 7-year retention period. They now have been moved up to 75 years, and that came about due to the Department of Justice's request to deal with firearms requests, firearms checks, as well as with the concealed carry permits here. And DOJ had asked for some sort of mechanism to be in place to have a long, long period of time that they can go out and check on that here. And so that's what led to these, because with recent changes in mental health law, as well as with the guardianship and protective placement area, that the firearm restrictions are, as I understand it, uniformly granted in just about every case here. So this surfaces in these matters here. So when Ms. Lundy's letter came through here, and I know Sally, she works on records management with me. She is the registered probate in my county. And I did personally speak to Sally about this. We discussed the change to deal with what happens with the death of a ward in a guardianship matter here. And that's what led to the change here to deal with this because of, ironically, when I was talking to her, she had files all over her office. And it's the guardianships that get very, very thick because of all the annual reports, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's all this work. And she has budget issues here. So with her suggestion, that's what led to our amendment in guardianship cases to reduce it, that if the ward died, and they believe it's our belief that there are sufficient safeguards as to notice when a ward does die, that file then can then be destroyed, even if there had been a firearm restriction before. We did not make that change when it came to the mental health files, and we did not make that change as it related to juvenile files here. That was in direct relation to DOJ's request. Sally, Ms. Lundy, represented to me that she was happy with the request, the change here as it related to guardianship files. As to the exhibits, we pretty well touched upon that. The big concern with that was in the criminal realm, because there had been many, many cases that we had been made aware of where the appeal time had already, under our existing rule, had elapsed. Things could be gone, destroyed, et cetera, and then appeals are granted much later in the game. And therefore, this rule, going from 1 year after the appeal time had expired up to 20 years, it was thought that gave sufficient time to deal with those types of cases. And then, of course, we deal with scanning. This has been wonderful in the circuit court level, at least from what I see here. I would use... Well, this dovetails into actual e-signing itself here. I would use that all the time here. Documents would be submitted to me electronically at work here. I could bring it up on the screen, check. I can look at the court record, and I can sign off on that electronically. And it cuts down on the amount of time that the clerks have to bring files down, or a judge going up to take a look at his or her files and then signing it to then be re-scanned into the file all over again. So it's e-signing is wonderful. But the scanning itself, that's something that's been ongoing for a long period of time, and it definitely has been working. It may be more time-intensive originally, but through time it's reducing the need for space issues that I know that several people who responded to this have been concerned about. It's working. It's working. So it reduces the scanning time essentially on court records themselves down to within 48 hours. It used to be up to 1 year, and that became problematic because the prior rule was 1 year after the final order was entered. Well, there could be this final order, and then in family cases in particular, there's another final order, another, and it goes on and on and on and on. So now with the ability to scan, these records themselves can be scanned very quickly, and once it's scanned, it's maintained. You have a record for it, and now the petition is asking that that original record, if it's submitted in original hard copy form, can then be destroyed and not held for 1 year.
Scanning is not required here.
Well, not required, but that's what's happening out in the field, Chief. It's not
very spotty.
Spotty?
It's very spotty. There are some counties that scan every day, and they're totally up to date on scanning. And there are other counties that don't scan because the clerk's office does not have the staff to do it. They have a scanner because we provide a scanner to them.
CCAP provides those scanners, as I understand it here. Right. So I know under Supreme Court Rule 7205, there are certain standards and safeguards that are built in that this court required to be done to ensure the accuracy of the record many, many years down the line here. CCAP supplies that out to everybody here, so those safeguards are maintained, so the record can be there. When you get to the budget issues, I know that's a concern. I've heard it in my own county here. Whether counties want to do that or not, I guess that's up to them individually to decide that. But we do that in Waukesha County here, and it's been working. I find it very effective.
Judge, I don't see or hear any other questions. And as Justice Bradley said, you have been in this field for a long time, and it's really a very detailed work. It takes great care and patience. And so, as I said, my eyes begin to glaze over when we're into the, 64th retention schedule in this rule. So I want to thank you on behalf
thank
of the
you.
Court
I appreciate
and thank
it.
The committee.
Appreciate it. Well, I got a couple more years to go here. my term is up in 2015, and I've decided I'm not going to run for re-election at that point.
Now is not the time to say that, Judge.
Well,
wait until
it's
2015.
I got a couple more years left on records management here, but the people that are on records management are wonderful. They do a yeoman's job here, and there I think had been some reluctance originally when we were coming up with all these forms and the pro se forms. I was hearing things and from judges and other litigants, why are you doing this, and this? But now what I hear, unless it's just because they're talking to me, is that in unison everybody is like thanking records management for the work that they do, and it's so easier on the bench to have these things here.
And the problem now is they want more forms. They want more records that you can give instructions on, and having watched the committee in operation with the computers going and everybody checking it out and changing as they go along, it's a very detailed work.
Well, we've streamlined things since Carlson left the committee here. So. Oh, go ahead.
Marsha, would you mark that in the record, please?
I'll hear about it later, I'm sure.
Right. Good. We'll call them instantly.
Okay. Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you, Judge.
Good to see you again.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Callender, David Callender, Wisconsin County Association.
Thank you, Chief, and fellow justices. It's always a pleasure to be here on behalf of the Counties Association. And I want to thank particularly Judge Kiefer on this issue and Ms. Peterson. I had a chance to talk with them earlier this morning. We from the Counties Association really understand the issue of records retention on behalf of our counties as a whole. And having staffed a committee that just recently developed an entire records retention schedule for all of the records the county government has to retain, I understand this is really painstaking work, very detail-oriented, and also very, very important in terms of the preservation of the appropriate records, the retention of them, and the importance of having those policies in place and standardizing them. Having talked with Judge Kiefer and Ms. Peterson this morning, I believe most of the issues that we identified in our memo to you have been addressed. It's my understanding that in talking with them, that there is no new additional requirements or mandates imposed in terms of the retention of physical evidence, and that there are policies in place on that. We do have some concerns in terms of the lengthening of the period of retention of these items. However, I think that's going to vary largely on a county-by-county basis in terms of just simply the space that they have available for the retention of these items. And at this point, having also spoken with both the sheriffs and the Clerks of Courts Association, it does not appear that this is going to create a substantial burden for the counties. But again, this may be something where, as the available space does fill up, this may be something where we have to come back to you and speak to you on that basis. But I believe that our purpose in simply providing the memo for you was to raise these issues, to seek clarification on them, and to make you aware of the potential that we may need to revisit this issue.
Who had discussed this with the sheriffs?
We have informed them of this. And as I say, the space that is available, in talking to a couple of individual sheriffs on this, and not to the Sheriff's Association as a whole, but in speaking with a couple of individual sheriffs, there are some very small confined spaces, as you might imagine, in some of the courthouses and in some of the sheriff's offices in the state. And so they do not view it as a problem at this point, but we do want to come back and, you know, make sure that, again, that these are not optical records. These are not computer records. So we want to make sure that this does not pose a problem to them in the future.
The court should adopt this rule. Does the county association have any plans for putting in their monthly magazines or in education that count that the sheriffs are alerted?
We would certainly be welcome to, we have an ongoing relationship with them, and of course they're their own organization, but we would be happy to work with them on this issue.
Justice Prosser.
I understand from your testimony then that you have no proposed language changes for the rule. Is that right?
That's correct, because it's my understanding that there is already a statute and regarding DNA samples and regarding the physical evidence, and there are already statutory governance. And I would leave that to Ms. Peterson, who has advised me of this areas. It's my understanding that there are already procedures in place for the handling of this physical evidence, and specifically with regard to the DNA evidence, that there are already standards for that. And there are already provisions for the destruction of such items as firearms, drugs, cash, that type of thing. So I think those areas appear to be addressed. And so the only question is then, what do we do with some of the other items? And again, that does seem to be something where it's worked out on a county-by-county basis.
You're expressing concern about the length of time.
Right.
Because that will increase the number and bulk of
right.
exhibits. But at this moment, you haven't run, as far as you know, space is still available, but that it may have to be re-examined.
Right, exactly.
If I understand.
Yeah, you. Time increases volume.
Could I ask a question that has really nothing to do with the rule? Suppose certain things are being kept, some exhibits are being kept, and the time has expired for keeping them. What happens to those exhibits if they have some value?
You know, I'm not entirely sure of that. I believe that there may be some that may be proffered, for example, to the Historical Society. It's my understanding from the rule that that is the case. As far as the actual underlying item, if it has value, I would assume that there would be some provision made for either its storage in the appropriate place if there's a county historical society, or that it would be something where if the item is sold for auction or something like that, I believe the revenue goes to the Common School Fund.
That's very good.
And I would again defer to the.
Okay. right. Well, I note that 7201, which I don't think has been amended, says, except as provided in 7203-05, is supposed to be kept in the court's custody. Unless it goes to the insurance, the historical society. So we'd have to assume if it's sent over to the sheriff's department that that's in the custody of the court.
Right.
I don't see or hear any other comments or questions, Mr. Callender. It's good seeing you again. And as always, we appreciate the County Association's interest and cooperation with us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear in regard to these SCRs relating to record retention? If none, I'm sorry.
Judge Kiefer was so very gracious in indicating that Amber Peterson was here for the first time for a presentation. And presentation.
And we should ask you to step up, and I'm going to hammer you with questions, Ms. Peterson.
The way we do it.
That's how we treat that.
It's simply, it might be a gracious gesture to invite Ms. Peterson to say anything she'd like to say.
My name is Amber Peterson, as you pointed out, and all I will say is Judge Kiefer only misspoke once in saying that I was here to present for the first time. Rather, I was here to observe a rule petition hearing for the first time.
When did you join the court system?
That's somewhat complicated. I interned here starting in law school in 2008, and then I was hired full-time in 2010.
And with the records management?
That's also complicated. I've done a few jobs with the Director of State Court's office, and starting in 2011, when Sarah Ward Cassidy was appointed Deputy Director, I filled her position as the Circuit Court Policy and Procedure Advisor, and that's when I started working on this petition.
So is it your position now that we've got you up here that if it goes to the Sheriff's Department, it's in the custody of the court?
It still is in the custody of the court. As you pointed out, per the rule and per the statutes, the clerk is the custodian of the records. From talking to clerks, depending on the county situation and resources available and the relationship they have with the sheriff's department, they may use the sheriff's department to store some items, but the clerks are still technically the custodians of those records.
And if it's lost by the sheriff or destroyed there?
Then it's... hopefully that doesn't happen, but ultimately that would be the clerk's responsibility to make sure that they are clear in working with the sheriff and make it clear that there are these retention periods in place and that the sheriff will have to honor those.
And does your office or does Ms. Ward have plans to not only further educate the clerk's office, but the sheriff's?
As far as the clerks, yes. Staff from our office, including myself, do present regularly at clerks' conferences and also at the regional specialty trainings, and we will definitely be talking to them about this. We don't have as much direct contact with the sheriff's department, but like I said, for counties, clerks that do use the sheriff's department, the clerks can work with their sheriffs and the staff to make it clear to them that the retention rules have changed and to be in constant communication so that exhibits aren't inadvertently destroyed.
Is there a question I should ask you and haven't?
I don't believe so. I can answer, though, as far as the Sheriff's Department on the letter to interested parties. The Badger Sheriff's Association was notified of the petition. I know that came up a little earlier.
Right, and some Sheriff's Departments may contract out, for example, with firearms. They don't want to keep every firearm, and so they'll contract out with a firearms company to safely keep those items. And then they have to comply. So there are different ways this is dealt with, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, and the clerk's office also contract out to places that have spaces that are temperature regulated, moisture controlled, etc.
Correct, yes, especially for those exhibits containing biological evidence, because the statute says they must be retained in such a way that a DNA profile could be made.
Oh, it covered, I think we had a matter that covered artwork that could be damaged. So, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, since we're calling on people, what about you, Ms. Ward? Do you want to say anything? We are now closing the hearing on 1205, in re amendment of a series of SDRs relating to record retention and electronically or optically stored records. The court will take a 15-minute recess and we'll come back for open administrative conference.